Chapter 3. The Algorithms of Memory. The next morning, the humor of the analog world vanished, replaced by the rugged, unyielding reality of a Tuesday. I stepped out of my building to find New York in a state of suspended animation. The air was not just cold, it was brittle. A crisp, static frost that seemed to freeze the breath before it could even leave your lips, leaving behind a jagged trail of crystalline molecules. I was alone, wrapped tightly in my heavy wool coat, treating the cashmere like armor against the relentless sensory input of the city. I wore it with the exact same unyielding haiba, that ancient blend of prestige and charisma. My ancestors wore their heavy wool jalaba against the biting, throat-stripping winds of the high Atlas. At the curb, the black Lincoln town car waited like a silent, obedient beast, its exhaust puffing white ghosts into the gray Manhattan air. I slid into the acoustic sanctuary of the back seat, the door closing with a heavy American steel thud that signaled the end of the external world. Immediately, the car phone trilled. It was Carmen, her voice crisp but laced with the manic background hum of the trading floor, where the brokers were already screaming at each other about the price of pork bellies and the fragility of hope. "Look, about last night. You recovered well," she pleaded softly over the line, walking the tightrope between ruthless sentinel and worried protector. "But Hoffman is waiting. Do me a favor, don't analyze the wind speed. Don't calculate the friction of his carpet. Just go in there and talk to the man. As a human, Adam, not a mainframe in a charcoal suit. And good morning to you too, Carmen," I huffed, adjusting my cufflinks. "Your bedside manner is, as always, reminiscent of a drill sergeant with a toothache. Save the charm for the Sunday crossword puzzle." She sighed, and I could practically hear her rubbing her temples. "I don't have time to manage your social protocols today. I am currently juggling 3 margin calls and a broker who thinks ethics is a brand of Scandinavian bottled water. Just go in there, act like a mammal, and try not to let him see the blue sparks behind your eyes." "I am merely going for a routine system diagnostic, Carmen," I said, leaning my head against the cold glass. "I'm not planning on a revolution." "Just go," she said, before the line clicked dead with a finality that felt like a falling guillotine. "The Upper West Side interface." The Upper West Side of Manhattan is a neighborhood designed for the intellectual elite to feel simultaneously superior and profoundly anxious. It is a landscape of limestone brownstones, Zabar's shopping bags, and therapists who charge $400 an hour to tell you that your childhood was not a tragedy, but rather a series of unfortunate software bugs. Stanley pulled the Lincoln to the curb with a whisper of brakes that suggested the car itself was trying to remain inconspicuous among the Volvos. I stepped out, and the razor-thin, frozen air of New York hit my charcoal Armani like a physical insult. I adjusted my Winchester collar. It was crisp. It was symmetrical. It was a lie, a starched barricade against a world that refused to stay in its lines. Dr. Hoffman's clinic was located in a pre-war building with an elevator that creaked like a Victorian ghost protesting its own existence. The ascent to the fourth floor was accompanied by a logged 0.4 psi drop in atmospheric pressure, a change I felt in the very marrow of my teeth. Hoffman opened his door. He possessed the rumpled, slightly exhausted posture of a man who spent his days absorbing the concentrated neuroses of the 10,024 zip code. His eyes behind his wire-rimmed glasses, however, were perfectly still and terrifyingly sharp. He was dressed for the academic part, a tweed blazer with leather elbow pads that looked like 2 small brown islands on a sea of gray wool. I sank into the heavy leather chair opposite his desk. The inner office was a sensory-dense environment. It smelled intensely of old paper, leather bindings, and sterilized dust, a particulate density that pressed heavily against my collar. Above us, the fluorescent lighting emitted a constant, irritable 60 Hz hum, F-sharp of cosmic annoyance that I immediately struggled to filter. Dr. Hoffman crossed his legs with a quiet rustle of tweed, wasting no time on pleasantries or the thermodynamics of the weather. My gaze dropped to the intricate, geometric patterns of his Persian rug, tracing a tessellation of 8 pointed stars to anchor my visual cortex. "Carmen told me about the garden last night," he began quietly. "She said you spun. Literally. Like a top that had lost its center." I stiffened, the leather of the chair groaning under my sudden tension. "A gross oversimplification," I replied, my voice a cold, calculated monotone. "I encountered a severe miscalculation of ambient decibels. From a strictly cybernetic standpoint, Doctor, I am simply a system optimizing its inputs. What you perceive as an emotional breakdown, I view as a necessary hard reboot to clear a corrupted cache. I was merely flushing the buffers. Hoffman smiled slightly, refusing to take the bait. An elegant defense, Adam. You build a Berlin Wall of logic between us, using words like cybernetics and optimization as if they were bricks. You wield Norbert Wiener's systems theory the way other men wield a shotgun. But tell me, do you rehearse this speech, or does your mind simply secrete it as an automatic cognitive antibody the moment you feel threatened? It is logic, Doctor, I countered, leaning forward slightly to engage in the academic sparring I found far more comfortable than feelings. Norbert Wiener defined cybernetics as control and communication in the animal and the machine. I am merely applying his axioms to my own chassis. Logic requires no preparation. Why search for messy, unregulated emotional meaning when we can simply analyze function and output? Ah, the neurotypical world, Hoffman mused, steepling his fingers. You speak of the rest of humanity as if we are a foreign species running on inferior, glitchy software. But even Wiener warned about entropy, Adam, the tendency of closed systems to inevitably degrade into chaos. Your logic is fundamentally flawed by its own isolation. You believe you are observing the world through a clean telescope, but your lens is cracked by your own refusal to be human. My lens is mathematically precise, I fired back, my pulse elevating to 92 beats per minute. I exist in the absolute truth of the integer. Gödel's ambush. Hoffman leaned forward, resting his elbows on his desk. He crossed the golden circle of my personal space, his scent of peppermint and old books invading my perimeter. I felt my pulse spike to 104. To stabilize my heart rate, I began counting the books on the shelf behind him. 412, categorized not alphabetically, but by the Dewey Decimal System. I inhaled deeply, the Chanel Antaeus on my neck flaring up like an olfactory shield. Do you know Kurt Gödel? Hoffman asked softly. I blinked, genuinely caught off guard. My eyes darted up from the intricate geometry of the Persian rug for a fraction of a second. I had prepared my firewalls for Freudian psychoanalysis. I had not prepared for a direct reference to the brilliant Austrian logician. Gödel's first incompleteness theorem, I recited, the data instantly compiling in my forebrain. You're suggesting that within any sufficiently powerful formal mathematical system, there are statements that are true but unprovable using the rules of that system. It is a fascinating boundary of logic, Doctor, but I fail to see its clinical application to my spinning at the garden. I was not a math problem. I was a man in a loud room. The application is absolute, Adam, Hoffman pressed gently. You are trying to build a complete, flawless logical system inside your mind to explain the world and to explain yourself. But Gödel mathematically proved that any logical system cannot explain itself entirely from within. You need an outsider. An irrational, messy observer, to see the system's flaws. You cannot code your own patch, Adam. You are too close to the source code. I felt a surge of heat in my chest, a localized data spike of adrenaline and cortisol. That is a categorical error, Doctor, I stated, my vocal output sharpening into a weapon. You are ignoring Turing. A Turing machine can simulate any algorithm given sufficient memory. If the system is vast enough, if the processing power is sufficient to account for every environmental variable from wind resistance to the 60 Hz hum of these lights, then the system becomes its own objective reality. I am not an incomplete theorem. I am a self-optimizing architecture. I am the programmer of my own response. Hoffman's eyes locked onto mine with an intensity that burned through my remaining defenses. And that is your final logic, isn't it? That you are the programmer, he said, his voice dropping into a tone of profound clinical pity. But Adam, if you are the programmer, why does the programmer suffer from a 200 millisecond latency between a physical event and the ability to feel an emotional reaction to it? Why does the programmer blue screen when the crowd noise hits a specific frequency? You are not the programmer, Adam. You are the code, desperately trying to understand the hand that wrote it. The diagnosis. Hans Asperger, the Austrian pediatrician, described a group of children who lacked the intuitive social wiring of their peers, but possessed a terrifying, almost divine focus on systems, numbers, and music, Hoffman explained. He called them little professors. I think you were a little professor who grew up to be an Atlas lion. But the lion is tired, Adam. He's tired of the noise. He's tired of the visual lag. That exhausting ghosting effect you experience when the world moves faster than your ability to process its color. The words died in my throat. I searched for a counter-algorithm, but my database returned void. Ghosting. It was a standard clinical term for him, a mere symptom of a visual processing delay, but to my processor it was a high-voltage data link to a specific afternoon in Marrakesh. I can overclock the processor. I can optimize the latency, I said. It was a weak, uncalculated defense, a logical fallacy. This is not just a personality quirk, Adam, Hoffman said softly. This is a highly specific neurodevelopmental profile. It is the reason you feel like a ghost in a machine. Hoffman leaned back, the leather of his chair creaking, a sound that felt like a tectonic shift in the room's geometry. He adjusted his glasses and looked at me with the weary finality of a judge. He slowly lifted a manila file and opened it. His lips moved with a slow, fatal precision. Asperger's syndrome? Syndrome, I whispered. My internal processor violently seized. Syndrome implied a defect, a clinical failure, a biological glitch demanding psychiatric mediation from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It sounded like something you treat with a pill and a sympathetic head tilt. You can't optimize a different operating system, Adam, he said, his voice dropping into a tone of clinical certainty. It's called Asperger's syndrome. It's not a disease, it's the fundamental architecture of your neurobiology. And you've been trying to run Human 2 on Logic 1 hardware for 33 years. No wonder you're exhausted. I am not a diagnosis, I whispered, my voice cracking, a rare, uncalculated error. No, Hoffman said gently. You are a sovereign exception. But until you acknowledge the architecture of your mind, you will always be at the mercy of the latency, that agonizing processing buffer between a physical event and your ability to feel it. The Medjdub defense. But as Hoffman's Western medical barcode attempted to overwrite my motherboard, an ancient, deeply encrypted firewall activated. My mind rejected the Upper West Side entirely and executed a massive, spontaneous data retrieval from the library of Darul Bacha. You call it Asperger's syndrome, I said, my voice returning to the clinical stillness of the office. You see a defect. But you are looking at an ancient, highly evolved Moroccan operating system and trying to diagnose it with an American software glitch. I am not a broken mechanism. I am a Medjdub. I remembered the old Moroccan texts, illuminated with gold leaf and lapis lazuli. I remembered the stories of Sidi Kadur El Alami and Abderrahman El Mehdub. These men were entirely disconnected from the trivial, analog gossip of their peers. They saw the mathematical truth of the universe so clearly, with such agonizing bandwidth, that the normal world seemed like meaningless static. Today, in a room like this, you would pathologize them. You would give them a clipboard and a prescription. But in my heritage, they were considered flawless, pure, and divine. They were not disordered, they were drawn to God. They were the bridge between the number and the soul. Hoffman leaned back, the leather of his chair emitting a dry, judgmental creak. That's a beautiful piece of mythology, Adam, he said, his voice dripping with the kind of gentle condescension used for children and the delusional. But we aren't in 17th century Morocco. We are in a clinical reality, what you call divine clarity, the rest of the world calls a pervasive developmental deficit. You aren't a mystic, Adam. You're just a very high-functioning accident of biology. The Orange Ghost, a memoir of kinetic schism. That was the last clear sound I heard. The audio cable in my brain violently snapped. I watched Dr. Hoffman's mouth continue to move in a viscous, stretched-out motion, but the audio feed cut to zero. Instead, my brain's visual cortex hijacked the auditory processing centers. It rendered the physical shape of Hoffman's noise, a gray, sinusoidal wave floating ominously in the empty space between us, perfectly mapped to the equation. I watched the wave rise and fall with a terrifying, precise geometric regularity, completely overriding my vision. And then, in that profound, sudden silence, the torturous 60 Hz flicker of the Manhattan fluorescent light completely vanished. Hoffman's clinical pity was a biological insult. He believed he was diagnosing a syndrome. I knew I was observing a revealing feature of the universe. To understand the gap, Hoffman didn't need a medical manual. He needed the summer of 1974. He had used the word ghosting to describe a deficit, but he didn't realize that I had a name for it long before I ever met him. While books provided me with a silent sanctuary in the Palace Darul Bacha Library, Football became my living laboratory. Our home, Riyadh al-Andalus, tucked within the historical neighborhood of Dar el-Basha, experienced a radical technological revolution that summer. My father had secured a new generation Thomson color television specifically for the upcoming World Cup in West Germany. He bought it because he assumed Morocco would qualify, just as they had in 1970. But the data didn't align. Morocco stayed home, Zaire became the sole representative for Africa. Recognizing the social capital of the glowing box, my brother Yusuf broke the family cordon and invited the neighborhood kids to join our viewing sessions. While my peers were spellbound by the total football of the Dutch squad, my mind was held hostage by the CECAM system, a French technical marvel that relied on a memory buffer to store and transmit colors sequentially. When the legend Johan Cruyff ignited his legendary bursts of speed, he committed an act of technical sabotage. His physical body moved at a velocity that the aging cathode ray tube simply could not track. For a fraction of a second, his material self would lunge forward into the vacuum, while his color lagged behind. I saw Cruyff running, and his orange jersey was following him in desperation to catch up. The scene was pure surrealism, a body liberated from color outrunning time, and a color without a body trying desperately to merge back into reality. Amidst the roars of the neighborhood children cheering for a dribble, I remained frozen. It was my first existential lesson. Reality is not solid. It is merely data subject to delay and processing. I realized then that my brain was simply a high-performance Thomson television, perpetually struggling to sync the world's raw movement with its own internal color. I was living in the gap. I was a CECAM processor in a PAL world. I snapped back to the present, back to the Upper West Side, back to the man in the tweed jacket who thought he had finally solved the puzzle of my soul. Hoffman was still leaning forward, his face a mask of professional empathy, waiting for the accident of biology to surrender to the diagnosis. He didn't realize that by giving it a name, he hadn't captured the lion. He had merely confirmed the architecture of the ghost. I looked at him, and for a fleeting second I didn't see a doctor. I saw a black-and-white broadcast trying to explain color to a CECAM processor. The friction was too much. The latency between his words and my reality stretched, thinner and thinner, until the signal could no longer hold the weight of the data. Then, the world went quiet, and I walked out into the frozen Manhattan air. A sovereign exception with a name I didn't want.